You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more. You're listening to a special interview in anticipation of the 2013 Just Food Conference. Just Food connects communities with the resources and support they need to make fresh, locally grown food accessible to all New Yorkers. Just Food also has a food justice program that increases awareness and action around food and farm issues and advances policies for a thriving local food system. The 2013 Just Food Conference will take place on Friday, March 29th and Saturday, March 30th. For more information and tickets, visit justfood.org.
All right, hello and welcome back once again. This is Nathaniel Coburn with another of our continuing series of interviews leading up to the Just Food Conference on March 29th and 30th. Tickets are still available for both days of the conference, as well as the Good Food Jobs networking event. Just Food has put together a fantastic lineup of speakers and workshops to suit all interests. Get your tickets at www.justfood.org. Today I'm on the line with Karen Washington. Karen has worked as an urban agriculture and social justice activist since 1985. Helping Bronx neighborhoods turn empty lots into gardens, and helping to launch a city farms market as a member of La Familia Verde Garden Coalition. In addition to serving on the boards of Just Food and Why Hunger, Washington co-founded Black Urban Growers, a volunteer organization which builds networks for growers in urban and rural settings. Professionally, Karen has been a physical therapist for over 30 years, and she continues to balance her professional life with community service. Good morning, Karen. How you doing?
Oh, good morning to you. Good morning to your audience.
When did you start to view food as central to your social justice work? Like, how did that become a focus?
Yeah, I think it started, after 98, sort of after Giuliani tried to auction off community gardens and were really fighting for garden preservation. It sort of took me out of the element of just bystander, just a person that, you know, I'm just going to grow food, I'm just going to make my neighborhood better. And what it did was really sort of ignited the activism juices, mm-hmm. and really started to look at community gardening more than just putting stuff, you know, in the ground and planting food, but looking at the broad spectrum of the food movement. And I think that was the start of my, really my food activism.
Mm-hmm. Now, you work with communities to transform empty lots into gardens. What's the process like?
Along with so many others, I just want to take my hat off to so many others, even before me, who were really at the in the trenches back in the late 70s and early 80s, mm-hmm. when at one point New York City had over 15,000 community gardens, and people mainly took back these empty lots as a protest. You know, they wanted to really protect their neighborhoods. Drug dealing was rampant, unemployment, and also people just thought this was a way to take back empty lots. And so for me, I mean, I was just one of the people that sort of jumped in, because where I live in 1985 was a brand new neighborhood of new homes, and in the middle of all these brand new homes were these empty lots, and they became eyesores. Mm-hmm. And as a result, like with so many other people, got the community together and started turning these empty lots into community gardens. First for beautification, mm-hmm. beautification, and for taking back the land, so to speak. And as a result, New York City now has over 500 community gardens. It really has been now at the forefront of this urban agricultural movement. And so it continues to be an element of city pride.
Hmm. Could you talk a little bit more about the connection that you see between health and the environment, particularly in low-income neighborhoods? I mean, you're talking about these gardens as a mm-hmm. As an aesthetic improvement, but it's more than that, right? I mean, it's public health.
It's more than that. It's more than that. A lot of empty lots, vacant lots, were in low-income neighborhoods and neighborhoods of color. and so I also sort of got my first insight on what environmental racism was all about, because usually in low-income neighborhoods, and where there were empty lots, a lot of developers came in and would put wanted to put like incinerators, waste plant productions, and so excuse me. So for us, it was more than just looking at gardening in terms of beautification, but looking at the whole system of institutional racism, structural racism in low-income neighborhoods, and looking at what that meant. So if you're growing food in low-income neighborhoods, you're looking at what's the dynamics around food. And it goes more than just growing plants, but it's eating. It's feeding ourselves. And then looking at the whole food chain within our neighborhoods to find out that we're being devastated with fast food, with processed food. And as a result of that, you're seeing the increase in health. So let me just sort of take you from the beginning of taking back empty lots and taking it for beautification and looking at the broad spectrum of our food movement and looking at the relationship to food and health and what we were eating, the processed food, the junk food, and as a result, the correlation that had then with the health problems that you see, the diabetes, heart disease, and obesity. So when we look at the food system as a whole, it's not isolated. It's not one solution. It encompasses right. so many different points.
Absolutely. So how does the process of transforming these empty lots into gardens further that cause? Like how does it actually translate into improved health and strengthen communities? Like what?
Because I think what has been lost along the food movement is our connection to land. Back in the early 1900s, 40% of us lived on farms, you know, but as the Industrial Revolution came into play and people started migrating from farms into the city, and we've sort of lost that connection. So as we stand now in the 21st century, there's a whole generation of young people have such a disconnect to their food. So they don't know where their food comes from. They think that food, you know, miraculously just appears because they go into a grocery store. And so what community garden urban farming movement is trying to do is to get people back to their roots, so to speak, to sort of start educating people exactly where their food comes from. Know the tomato is not grown in the supermarket, but actually where it's grown. And then also to have the conversation between food and culture, which is so, so important. So you see these community gardens and urban farms now taking into play not only growing food, but the relationship to food and culture, relationship to food and history. And so now you're starting to see a new birth, a new interest in that connection, which in terms brings in the conversation of healthy food and healthy eating. Because if you look back, if you talk to your great-grandparents or your grandparents, they didn't have the illnesses that we have now. And so if you look at the correlation between the food that they got on the land, on a farm, which was fresh, no pesticides, and now you're looking at the food that we have, which is basically processed food, and God knows what else, you know, is sprayed on the food, that now you're starting to see the correlation between food and health.
In terms of the people who you're able to get involved in these programs, what's the age demographic like? Like, are you getting a lot of young people interested?
A lot of young people are now really coming to the forefront. And because, first of all, they're more savvy. I think the internet and social media has really, really played a part in awareness of what's going on. That's number one. Number two, they're looking at their parents, and they're looking at the health problems that their parents and their grandparents are having, and they're saying, wait a second, I don't want to be like this. You know, I don't want to be hooked to a machine where I have to, you know, take myself to dialysis 3 times a week, or I don't want to lose a limb or be blind because I have diabetes or hypertension. So I think a lot of young people are starting to look at what is happening in the health arena and saying, you know what, I have to be healthy. Also the fact that you see young kids, 10, 12, were obese. You know, we didn't have that, you know, growing up. And so I think there's a lot of young people coming on board, looking at the food system, and really getting involved to change it. And I think that's really important.
Mm-hmm. You are a co-founder of Black Urban Growers, a volunteer organization dedicated to nurturing collective black leadership in food and farm issues.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that one of the guiding questions when you began was, why don't we see more black farmers at farmers markets? 4 years later, are you still asking the same question? Has the palette changed?
I'm still asking the same question. I'm still not only at farmers market, but in farming in general.
Right.
I'm still asking that same question, and I will continue to ask that same question because, you know, people are using the term sustainable agriculture, and I'm looking at, well, you know, sustainable. There's got to be a mechanism where there has to be inclusion. And I don't see that. I really don't see that. So as a representative of Bugs, what we're trying to do is to break down that barrier and open doors and expose the opportunities that should be there for young people of color in the farming movement, because it's just not there. I mean, I go to many conferences, organic conferences, and I see, you know, thousands and thousands of people, but when I get there, I can count on my fingers exactly how many people look like me. Mm-hmm. But yet, you know, everyone is talking about agriculture, sustainable agriculture in such a way, you know, that it's becoming progressive. But for me, I still see that there are doors that are shut, and those doors need to be knocked wide open. And as Bugs, that's what we plan on doing, just opening those doors to at least allow the opportunity for people of color to be in the farming movement.
Why is it important to have black farmers? I know that sounds like a strange question,
you know,
but I'm going to ask it anyway. Like, why?
That seems to be an obvious question, but I'm going to answer it for you.
Please do.
If you look at the history of the United States, you know, we came here, you know, not by choice, but in chains. We came here with bringing our culture, and we were the people that were feeding this country. You know, we were, as slaves, growing the food. You know, we brought a lot of our culture and our history here. And at one time, we were the caretakers of the land. You know, let's talk about history. We were the caretakers of the land. And now, with Jim Crow and racism, a lot of us lost our land. A lot of us lost our land. And as a result, people tend to forget, you know, they've forgotten the history of the United States, the history of America, and the part that African Americans and black people and people of color have played in the history of agriculture. And I think it's paramount as we move forward. This is the 21st century. It's not the 20th century. It's not the 19th century. Mm-hmm. This is the 21st century. And if we're moving in a direction whereby the complexion of these United States is changing to be more colorized, then people of all color need to be at the seat of the table when we talk about food and agriculture. And so if you're really serious about a sustainable agricultural movement, then when you sit down and you break bread and you look at the table that you're eating your bread, and you don't see different people of color, or you're seeing the same color, then something's wrong. So we need to have that conversation, and we will continue to push the envelope when it comes to our seat at the table around agriculture and food. We no longer just want to be consumers. You know, we don't want to be consumers. We want to be stakeholders. And I think it's fair and just, as black America, as black Americans and as black America, wake up. We need to be at the seat of the table when it comes to food and agriculture.
Absolutely. And continuing with the seat at the table question, I wondered if you wanted to take a minute to talk about the TEDx conference last month. I understand that you backed out, and I'm curious as to what happened and why, if you want to talk about it.
Well, that's in the past. I'm just going to just talk about it a little, I mean, because that's in the past, and I think from that we need to move forward. Again, it's, you know, from time to time, people tend to fall back to the stereotypes of what it means to be a black proud woman in America. Mm-hmm. And so you still have those people who have the attention that we're going to make waves or be disruptive. And so a lesson to be learned is, again, don't judge a book by its cover. Really get to know the person. Don't listen to hearsay. And so all those elements were in play when it came to the TEDx event. And so as a result, I think that what Tanya did was absolutely excellent, is to have the Tanya Talks and to bring in people who were denied the access to really talk about the problems that we as people of color deal with each and every day in our neighborhoods. And she was able to provide that platform whereby she showcased the work that she has been doing along with the work that other people have been doing in neighborhoods of color, and allowed us to have a platform to discuss those challenges and benefits in an open arena. And so it was absolutely excellent. I praise Tanya for having it. I encourage her to continue to have the Tanya Talks because, again, it allows a platform for people who don't have a platform to speak to talk about the good work that is happening in our neighborhoods. Because I think for so long, you know, I always hear, I know that I live in a low-income neighborhood. I know that there are issues and problems. I know about that. I don't need to hear that constantly. What I need to hear is the good things, the positive things that are happening in my neighborhood. And I think with the Tanya Talks, you really got a chance to see the array of knowledge and good work that's being done in the Bronx. And people were surprised. People who've never been to the Bronx were surprised about the element and the wealth of information and things that are happening in the Bronx. So my hat definitely goes off to Tanya and the Tanya Talks.
Well, for our listeners, tell us about some of those wonderful things that are happening in the Bronx right now.
Either. we're starting our Bronx tourism. 3 years ago, we started with the borough president's office to showcase some of the community gardens and some of the urban farms in the Bronx. With the Bronx Tourism, we were able to get the trolley during May and up until October. The trolley gets visitors from all over. They get on board at Columbus Circle, and they travel to the Bronx, and they go from various urban farms and community gardens where they get off the trolley and engage in workshops and conversation. They have lunch, and it really, really gives a chance to people to see exactly what is happening in the Bronx. With Bronx Green Up, we have yearly workshops that take place in the Bronx, anywhere from composting, taking care of chickens, you name it, that's going on in the Bronx. A couple of weeks, we'll have our annual Green Thumb, where over 2,000, I would say close to maybe 3,000 people from all over the city and from out of state come and really participate in some of the most fantastic workshops that are now being taught by community gardeners and urban farmers. And so it just highlights some of the positive things that are happening, and there's agencies and there's organizations that are doing work to stem the tide of obesity, doing work around food, also incorporating not only community organization but faith-based organization, and I think that's important as well. So things are happening in the Bronx, things are happening in other boroughs, and I think it's a good time to be in New York City as a whole.
Oh, absolutely. You started your own garden a while back, right? The Garden of Happiness, is that correct?
Yes, the Garden of Happiness was just started back in 1988.
And it's still going?
It's still going strong. This morning I had to get up this morning at 6 o'clock this morning to shovel snow and go out there and feed the chickens. Community Gardens Urban Farms. You know you got to be out there shoveling the snow in front of your gardens. Mm-hmm. That's number one. That's important. But then those that have livestock, we have to get in there and make sure we feed our chickens, and they need food and they need water. So.
What all do you have? You have chickens. You have. Do you have other animals? Do you have?
No, I just have. We just have chickens. We wish we can have some goats, but we just have. We have chickens, and we have. Of course, we have cats. Mm-hmm. You know, we have garden cats, so they need to be fed. So this morning, I know a lot of the listeners that have livestock and kittens, and cats are out there this morning shoveling snow and tending to our animals.
And with the. Where do the chickens go?
The chickens have a coop. Mm-hmm. The chickens have a coop. A lot of people say, well, how do they survive in the winters? Chickens are very hardy. And then we have a lot of hay. Mm-hmm. And believe it or not, the hay, when we turn the hay acts almost like compost, you know, and so it generates heat. They are survivors. Chickens are survivors. So if you tend to really block the wind, they don't like wind. Wind is not good for chickens. So if you have a coop and it's somewhat insulated, we have a lot of hay that we put around our chicken coop. We make sure we put panels up to block the wind. Chickens are sturdy, and they are hardy and fun to be with.
Are these for eating or for eggs?
Our chickens are for eggs. Our chickens are for eggs. We sell our eggs at our farmer's market, so the La Familia Verde Coalition, we have a farmer's market. This will be our 10th year. Yay, for a farmer's market, and people love our eggs. I mean, you know, I mean, you just can't compare to store-bought eggs.
Mm-hmm. Now, since you began working as a food justice activist, you've and as a lifelong New Yorker, you've seen this movement grow. I mean, there's just been waves of changes over the past 20 years, policy measures, public health campaigns, and the like, geared towards combating hunger and obesity in low-income and predominantly Black and Latino communities. And there's a lot of nonprofits talking about and working on these issues right now. What's worked and what hasn't in your experience?
Okay, the work, first of all, the intentions of groups and nonprofits have worked. I mean, they have really come to the forefront to sort of help publicize, you know, what's going on. What has not worked is for groups to come into our neighborhood and feel that they are the savior. Mm-hmm. That doesn't work. That's not going to work. What is going to work is for nonprofit organization and outside organizations coming into our neighborhoods and asking what we need. What are some of the resources that we need? Because we already know how to fix things. So we don't need a person that's going to come in and from the outside and try to fix our neighborhoods. Because like I had said initially, we already know what the problems are. Mm-hmm. But we can use resources, and we can use people who are willing to work side by side, but not people who are going to come into our neighborhoods and tell us what to do.
What kinds of policies would you like to see in the Bronx? And if you can speak to that, what does the Bronx want, if you can speak for that?
Yeah, well, I think jobs. I think jobs and resources. I think for too long, again, like I said, you know, it's the hand that is the hand that we're not at the table. We need to be stakeholders at the table. That's number one. Mm-hmm. We need to, what I would like to see in terms of this urban agriculture movement is look more towards enterprise. There are so many people in the Bronx that know how to do it. And I'm not saying that, and I'm not talking about the Bronx, but I'm talking about specifically in low-income neighborhoods, and that goes for Brooklyn, and that goes for Manhattan. There is a wealth of entrepreneurship in our communities. There are people who know how to bake, people who know how to can, people who know how to cook. Mm-hmm. They just need a chance for an enterprising system in New York City whereby these people can have the backing to market their product. Mm-hmm. You know, without all this red tape, without this, or, you know, because if you want to get people off the welfare system, you want to get people to have jobs, then have it so it's easy for someone to who makes that sofrito or that salsa at home, that they can put their stamp, their picture, and sell it. That a person that can the best peaches and make the best jelly and jams, that person has a role to put their face and their stamp on that jelly and jam, and I can see it in the local supermarket. Mm-hmm. For those people who are raising bees, that honey can have a Bronx honey stamp, a Brooklyn, a New York City stamp. So this is what I see for the foreseeable future that I want to see. I want to see now the emphasis on enterprise, giving people a chance now to own something. Because for me, that's where the next direction is. It's enterprise, getting people employed, getting people off of public assistance, getting people the tools, the resources they need for their innovations. Mm-hmm. That's what I want to see.
So like maybe a network of expanded incubator programs, something.
Incubator
like that?
Programs. Mm-hmm. With resources, financing, I want to see that. I want to see that, and I want to see it geared towards those who are less fortunate. Not for those that already have the money, mm-hmm. but I'm talking about the people that don't have the money, but they have the knowledge and they have the innovation. They just need that help to see that product or their whatever they have, their wares, their product to fruition. I want to see that.
You're going to be speaking at the Just Food Conference Friday morning, March 29th. What do you know what you'll be speaking about yet?
Yeah, I do. And because they asked us to come up with a title and basically to talk about a little bit about ourselves. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to talk about myself in terms of food, justice, and faith, and the reasons why I grow food. Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about that, you know, for people to know me a little bit better and also talk about what are the things that drive me. So those are the three things that I think that drive me in this movement. I want to talk about my relationship to food, why, and how I got involved in the justice movement, and then talk about my relationship to the work that I do, to my faith, mm-hmm. which is so important. So if you're around, you'll get a chance to know me a little bit better, I plan on listening to other people who are going to be on the panel, and it should be very interesting, eye-opening. There may be things that people don't know about us, but it gives us a chance to really talk about the things that we do and the things that move us.
Well, I'm very excited to hear it. Thank you so much, Karen, for speaking with me today.
And thank you so much, Heritage Radio. I've been on it before, but thank you so much for opening the doors and allowing so many of us to have a voice in the movement. So thank you as well.
Absolutely. Folks, stay tuned with us because we'll be having more conversations in anticipation of the upcoming Just Food Conference on March 29th and 30th. You can find more information about the conference by visiting www.justfood.org. I want to thank you for tuning into this program. This show, like all of the more than 30 shows featured on Heritage Radio Network, is available for free on our website, www.heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.